in 30, 40, 50 hours of material. And every frame, every 24th of a second, you're choosing not to cut to any one of those other frames in that 50 hours of material.
Hello and welcome back to the Post-Production Club podcast. My name is Luke Fritz, the producer of the show.
And I'm your host, Gavin Buckland. Today we have Matt Platts-Mills. He is the editor for Guy Ritchie's new Netflix show, The Gentlemen, which is a continuation of the story from the 2019 film, also by Guy Ritchie. I'm excited for you guys to hear from Matt today. He's an incredibly introspective man who cares a lot about story. He shares about his journey of breaking into the industry, the skills and practices that every editor needs and that have helped him succeed, and what it's like to work with Guy Ritchie and how Guy stands apart from other directors. All right, let's dive in. Welcome to the Post-Production Club podcast, Matt.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Nice to meet you, Kevin.
You as well. Would love to hear a little bit about you and where you're calling in from.
I'm calling in from North London, sunny North London. Well, it's been tipping it down for about 6 months now. That's where I am.
So I want to hear definitely about your process, your journey in editorial, your work on The Gentlemen, the new series that's on Netflix from Guy Ritchie. But first, I kind of wanted to hear about your journey into editorial in your work on big budget TV shows. So how did you start?
I started late, I guess. I mean, I think a lot of people start, well, I don't know. You hear stories of people starting and knowing they want to do something, knowing they want to be a director, knowing they want to be an editor, knowing they want to compose music. But I don't think I really made that connection until in my late teens, maybe early 20s. So I tried to go to medical school for a long time. And I'm not doing a great job of achieving that. And it had been, I must have been 8 or 9 when I first saw Alien, so the Ridley Scott film, which scared the living hell out of me. But at the same time, I was completely entranced by it. Like I'd never seen anything that kind of moved me in that way, scared me, absorbed my mind in that manner. I didn't know at the time that that's what I was going to do, but it definitely had a huge effect on me. And then a couple of years later, I saw 2001, A Space Odyssey. And again, I was completely absorbed by this thing on the screen in front of me and taken into this journey. But again, it didn't click that this was something that I wanted to pursue until much later, until my late teens, when I'd not done particularly great my A-levels. And I sort of stopped the whole medical school thing and decided I'd go and do, art and filmmaking. And that's what that, and so that's where I ended up. And I did a few years of that in college. And then abandoned college. I've got a lot of giving up in my career. Abandoned college and moved to London, just to pursue a job, really. And still, I wasn't really paying attention. So I moved to London thinking I could just walk into a job somewhere. And so I went around to a load of these companies and said, I'm an editor. And one of them turned around and said, well, I think you're probably more like a runner. And I said, yeah, that'll do. Take that job. They had a very early Avid. So I was kind of au fait with Avid. And then this production company was a corporate video company that I got a job at. They had an Avid and another thing called a video machine. And they had no editor. So I basically camped out in the cutting room, and they very quickly figured out that it was a lot cheaper to pay me to cut everything than it was to pay an editor to cut everything. So very quickly probably 6 months of cutting almost everything that came through the door. And within a year, I was kind of sort of head of poster. And at the same time, friends of mine who were having all this, they'd all moved to London and a year earlier. And they got glamorous jobs in commercials companies. They had these glamorous jobs in Soho, working for commercials companies, like really big commercial companies with these fantastic directors and these beautiful buildings. and I was working in West London, as far, but almost as far as we get from the center in this little corporate video house. And what's interesting about corporate videos, or at the time, was that a lot of people, particularly directors of photography, early on in their careers would be doing, they'd be doing their commercials, they'd be doing short films, they'd be doing music videos, but they'd also go and do a corporate video. So they, these people would come through the corporate video house I was working at. And obviously me being very keen, I'd be like, hey, would you like, if you want to check out this thing that I've cut, do you want to watch this video, this thing I've made? I'd show it to them and they'd say things like that. They'd be like, oh, that's really good. You should meet this director I've worked with. I think he'd really find the work you do really interesting. One of the DPs was Tim Cragg, was really into, he'd do a lot of frame of refocuses and reframes and lots of whip pans. And I showed him a music video. He was working in documentaries and I showed him a music video that incorporates a lot of work, so very quick cutting and making use of the reframing and the whip pans and the refocuses. And he just said, this is great. You should meet this director I'm working with. We're about to do something a bit like this. And he introduced me to this guy called Russell Barnes. And Russell was doing this documentary about a guy who bought and sold secondhand trainers. And this is before the internet, so you couldn't just go on and do what kind of stuff. And so we did this little video, and the DP was just lots of reframes, constant movement within the frame, lots of whip pans. And so it was a very energetic piece of work. And I put in lots of kind of, at the time, new music. As it was trip hop and kind of dance music and things like that. And this director was very, very pleased with it. And he said that he took it out and he got more positive comments from that than anything else he'd shot and directed. And he promised that he would give me the next direct documentary that he got commissioned to do. And he didn't give me the next documentary. He gave me the one after that. And then I worked with him for 9 years. So I'd always wanted to get it to film at the time. And about 2007, the Red Camera came out. So it was sort of the first true digital shooting format. And we bought, I think it was the 247 was the number. And I think it was like the second or third one to be delivered in the UK. We got in really early. We booked it. And we were like the second or third one to be delivered in the UK. We set about trying to figure out, purely so we could make short films, how to get this thing to work. And we started, and I think we were one of the first people, independent people, to actually shoot Red Camera back to film. And we got these very beautiful images out of it. And about that time, John got his first feature film. And of course, you know, being a documentary editor at the time, the producers were not very interested in letting me cut the feature film, even though I'd cut John's short film. But the fact that I knew how to work with a Red Camera, and they were really quite keen on making the film look great for not a lot of money, that kind of bought me the job. So in 2008, suddenly I was cutting my first feature film. But it's a hard transition. Like, it is a hard transition. It's very difficult to get that first film, especially if you've already developed a career in another area. So, you know, I mean, everyone has a different journey. But my advice would be try and get into the area that you want to be in early and then work hard. And so then I just cut my first horror feature film. And so there I was now cutting features. Quite a low budget, some horror sort of VFX stuff, some... there was one called Grabbers, which was about an alien that lands off the coast of Ireland. It's a blood-sucking, man-eating alien, but the only way to avoid being eaten is to get incredibly drunk. And obviously, mayhem ensues.
That's an extremely Irish horror film.
It is an extremely Irish horror film, isn't it? What else?
It's a fantastic concept for an Irish film.
Yeah, isn't it? I mean, it's the one film that that people actually stop me. If I meet people at an event and they've seen Grabbers, they will stop me, say how much they love it, and then describe the entire plot to me. particularly if they're Irish. It's like, yeah, but they really enjoyed it. And then I had this very interesting experience. And about 2012, so quite a long way into my career, I was working on a film that was having trouble in post, is a polite way of putting it. So the producers, as they often may do, as if you're an editor, you'll find this turns up quite often in post, much more often than you think. They wanted to bring in a fresh pair of eyes, someone else to have a look at the film. So I said to them, yeah, that'd be great. Let's do that. Let's get someone in super experienced. I'd love to work with them. It'd be really interesting. And so they went away. And first round, they got back some people who were sort of just a little bit above my level. So they'd done a bit more TV and maybe the same number of features or it's something similar like that. Or maybe a few more features and a little bit more TV. And I turned around and said, look, you know, let's get someone like Petra Scarlia. Wouldn't that be amazing? And they said, well, okay, well, I'm going to go and get Petra Scarlia. I mean, I can't believe that I was sort of driving the process. I mean, maybe I was, maybe I wasn't. But it felt a bit like I didn't want to work with those guys. Let's get someone really good, Petra Scarlia or Chris Gill. And so they went and said, oh, yes. And they came back with an artist called Mick Audsley, who is an absolutely wonderful human being, but also extremely experienced. He cut Goblet of Fire. He cut Interview with a Vampire. So he's had this enormous CV of really great films. And he and I sat down together and started working through this film. What was really interesting about the experience is he'd watched it before and gone, okay, what do you think can happen? What do you want? And they'd said, well, we'd like you to improve it. We think there are these problems. Da, da, da. And he'd said, okay, I'll have a look. We sat down and he said, don't give me the notes. Let's just watch the film. And when I feel like something's gone wrong, we can stop. So he then started to watch through the film and he would just go, okay, just there. And every time he stopped, it would be at the point that someone had given a note. It was kind of like, it's that good. You're like, oh, here. Oh, yep, this is a note. He said, don't tell me though. What I feel is happening is X, Y, and Z. You're like, yep, that's kind of the note they've given. He said, okay. When do we first think about this? From like, what do you mean? When does this idea first crop up? Well, about 5 minutes earlier, you know, this and this happens. It's like, well, let's go back 5 minutes and see what the problem is. And we chop back, and that experience really began to open my eyes to you. And it's strange. I sort of been subconsciously doing this stuff before, but never consciously thinking about it. It seems incredibly naive now. How we can now say it, really opened my eyes to story arcs, character arcs, story structure, themes, tone, all these really intrinsic parts of editing. And he would pick it to pieces shot by shot, frame by frame. You know, in as much as saying, I think that shot is just a few frames too short. Because no one's recognizing that's happened. Or I think you've introduced this idea one shot too early. Because the moment you introduce this idea, everyone forgets previous idea. And therefore they forget the story beat. They miss the story beat that you're trying to introduce at that point. So just shuffle that up a little bit more. It's not really possible to land this idea because it has no dramatic consequences. And the only way the audience will recognize this idea is if it has dramatic consequences. So it's very hard to chase this concept that they're asking for. And it was really that moment that made me really start to focus on all those things. I started reading script writing books, reading scripts, now writing some of my own scripts, and really started to dig into that side of, and again, it feels naive now not to have started that before, but really consciously digging into story and character. And then I was offered this show called The Enfield Haunting, which is a lovely little, I don't know if you get Sky over there or how you get all that stuff, lovely little horror, let's call it, mini series at 3 episodes. And a really fantastic team, helmed by Christopher Nyman. And And it was one of those shows that you're just very lucky to be on. It's kind of, it's hard work, but it's kind of got the golden ingredients that makes it really good. So it's hard work, but not super, super intensely stressful. And the cast just worked really well together. The crew worked really well together. The director's on point, and it's just all kind of funneling towards a really fun. The script really works. It's all funneling towards a really great show. And it was that point that I started to really, what was the first time I really started to think about all these things together, out of character arcs and structure and inflection points. And yeah, it was really interesting. And it was a great little show. It surpassed what the executives were expecting of it. Let's put it like that. They were very surprised at how well it did, which was just really great. And it's a really solid. A really solid horror piece. It was around that time that I got a fantastic agent, which can be very useful. And okay, so some people out there be like, "Oh, how do you get an agent? This is a good thing." So I think the best way to get an agent is to be introduced to them by a producer, because I think what goes on in their heads at that point is, okay, so this producer likes this guy, I like that producer. And this producer is likely to give this guy more work. So that's one tick in the, I don't have to push this person too hard for. So I think the best way to get an agent is to be introduced. So if you're working on a project and you've just done something and you're working with someone you get on with, you know, ask them. That's what I did. I asked the producer of The Enfield Haunting, you know, who's your favorite agent? Put me to Chris Gill. And they were fantastic. They started putting forth all sorts of really great jobs, one of which was a series called The Alienist on Netflix. Yep. And that was a complicated show. And I initially turned up to do just one episode, but for various reasons, I ended up taking a lot more responsibility across that series. And it was a very intense cut. And we had a super hard deadline as well. I think they had to get it out. I might have been for the Golden Globes or something. But there was an imperative for this to be released at a certain date. And I think that's quite helpful. Sometimes shows can keep going, and people fiddle with them more and more and more because they want to get it perfect. And I think you can sort of lose the freshness of a series that way. More and more voices coming in. Whereas if you've got a hard deadline, it really focuses people's minds. Everyone's pushing towards getting this thing out. And I ended up cutting across the majority of the series. And again, that was very lucky. And it was a great experience because I learned how to sort of do the notes really quickly. But I often think that I often find that looking at the notes is a really good indication of where people feel the show isn't quite working. And sometimes the notes that they give with it, the offered solutions, are not necessarily very helpful. But the notes itself is extremely helpful. I don't know if you've heard the expression, don't do the note, do the note within the note.
What's one way that you decipher what is actually behind the note? How do you address the actual concern?
So, yeah, that's interesting. That's a great question. So you sort of look at what's happening at that moment in the film. And it's always about story and character. And I think if you understand story or tone, if you understand story, character, and tone, you can kind of begin to unpick the note within the notes. Someone might say, I don't like it when X happens. And that's actually what they're saying is, or could be saying, or often saying, it's at this point that the character does something that I don't really understand, or it doesn't feel in keeping with that character. Or it might be, there's something missing in the story at this point, and they're off doing something that I don't really understand. At which point you have to then sort of examine, you know, what do you want to do? What do you want to achieve in this moment? Do you want to try and underline the idea that you were initially pushing for? Or do you want to move in a different direction? So is the character, and that can be something you can underline a facet of that character by going back in the film, opening something up, you know, delivering more of that idea earlier. So when you arrive at this point, it's not a surprise. It doesn't bump you. Yeah, because you've created this character, you've rooted this character more firmly earlier. And now when you arrive at this point, that everyone's happy that this character's angry or a bit upset or whatever it is at that point. So it's about unpicking what it is within the structure of the story that's causing people to bump on that moment.
Yeah. So you worked in music videos, then working on documentaries, cutting documentaries, you get a shot at cutting a feature, you cut another one, and then you get brought onto TV. You're working on The Alienist, which is a show on Netflix. How did you get introduced to Guy Ritchie to get onto The Gentlemen?
Well, that's, you build up a CV, right? And none of these things, all these things led towards working with Guy. I was very lucky. I haven't mentioned Taboo, but I worked on Taboo with Ridley Scott. And that was just a dream moment. And all these credits, it's a very credit-led business. If you have the credit, then people, they don't care where you went to school. They don't care what other hobbies you have. They just look at the list of credits. And then if you've got enough credits in there, they'll take an interview with you. And then they'll decide whether they like you based on that interview and how well you get through the interview. So I'd done a little feature the previous year, and then I was just between jobs, and the industry was very quiet at the time. And I got a call. My agent had put me forward. I think they had somebody already on board the series, and the series was already, I think it's 3/4 shot. It was just the last two episodes that were being done. And the director, Aaron Creevy, who I absolutely adore working with, he had an editor he really wants to work with called Nick Alex. And but he'd only done music videos before. So Aaron had taken quite a big risk of getting bored. So Nick had assembled both episodes, because Aaron had shot two. They're shooting blocks, so Aaron was shooting two episodes. But they were still looking for another editor, because obviously it's very hard to have one editor doing two episodes because of the schedule. So back-to-back episodes is tough, because when you deliver your first episode, you have like sometimes only a few days before they're giving you notes and you're doing changes, and you just don't have time to be cutting another episode. So back-to-back episodes. So you might leapfrog, but back-to-back is tough. So Nick couldn't take on the second episode, and they still hadn't found an editor they were super happy to work with. I think they'd gone out three times, and it was on this third meeting that I met with Iran and Laura, the producer. And we just hit it off on the Skype call. But I wouldn't have got that meeting if I didn't have the credits behind me. And the specific credits are, you know, the types of films that I've been working on, the types of TV shows I've been working on, the level of TV shows I've been working on. And Iran was looking for somebody who had kind of not just comedy, but also some of the thriller aspects. And I think he said to me afterwards, when I got off that call, I knew I'd been speaking to somebody who knew what they were talking about. Okay, good. I'd done well in that interview. So he took me on to do episode 6. Then he shoots so well. He's just a very considered director. He's got a real eye. He's great with performance, and he's one of these directors who really puts scenes together in a very, I say formal, but he actually switches between formality and informality. He has these very formal tracking or sweeping shots, and then it'll also jump into kind of lots of handheld for feisty that. And he's got lots of directorial tricks, and it was, I hate to say it, but it was kind of like an easy show to cut, episode 6, just because he'd done such a great job. You know, you get great performances, you shoot it really well, and then it makes my life, and it's written really well, it makes my life really easy, because I can focus on making a great piece of work rather than fixing things. And so that's how I managed to get onto the Gentlemen's. It really is the credits that I'd had up to that point.
Well, it got you the meeting, but I think you could have done something that really didn't win you the meeting. So what would you say are the key ingredients to actually get the job after you've got that meeting booked?
So, yeah, I think that's a really good question. And honestly, I have no idea. I tend to try... I mean, meetings are tricky because people on the other side will come to the meeting with an agenda. So, you know, and they'll be at a certain point in the process. They'll have certain expectations. So you might be the editor that they really want, you know. So they've been pushing to get you. They've seen some work you've done. I mean, I knew I wanted to work with Iran. The moment they called me, I was like, I tried to get a job with him. I think I'd taken a meeting with him like 10 years previously for a feature film, and he hadn't chosen me. So I was quite gutted at the time. But then when I heard he was doing this and he asked for a meeting, I was like, I really want to work with this guy. And so people come to these meetings, the director, the team will come to the meetings. They have their own agendas. They have things. So you might be the guy they really, really want to work with. They've seen something you've done before. Or you might really not be the guy that they really want to work with. And you can't tell. They might have their sights set on, you know, a really big editor, and your meeting is like a courtesy meeting because your agent has put you forward, and it's, you know, and actually the editor they really want, and it's not just you, it's not just editors, this is across all grades. You know, the person they really want is also at that agency, and so they'll take a meeting with you, and then they'll go back, they go, well, we'd really like to meet this person, can we have a meeting with them? So you don't know, you know, what your chances of getting this job are. I just go in and I talk about scripts, I try and talk about filmmaking in general. I talk about character and structure, and I try not to be too much of an a-hole. And I think that's just one of the most important things.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, that'll get you far in life.
Yeah, try.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. So it sounds like, too, they were reflecting on how you really knew your stuff. So bringing in like that decade, you know, of experience that you had in cutting so much other stuff, very technically minded, you're an expert in your field, and that you can't fake that. And that's really cool that was noticed and picked up on. Did the Gentleman, the movie that came out in 2019, I'm curious if that influenced any of your editorial decisions at all in the show? Or of your process?
That's very, yes, good question. It's very interesting. Every show is different. So the fingerprint, the DNA of every show is different. And that DNA is based on the script, on the team that shoots it, on the actors and their performances. And obviously, as an editor, you can manipulate that DNA in many, 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 many ways. But I try very hard. I'm a performance and character driven editor. So that's what I look for first of all in the rushes. I look for the characters. I look for performances that I could build something out of. I try and protect performances, create the greatest performances I can. And part of that DNA film is the way that it's shot, how the performances and characters are framed. I don't mean framed as in with the shot. I mean framed in the world, you know, how the team have been creating this world. So I try to be really sensitive to that team's tone, to their creation, and that's what drives me in the cut. Yes, I'm always looking for, and the director, some directors will have. Every director's style is very different. So some directors will really force the perspective, create through the film techniques they use, really trying to immerse. I mean, everyone tries to immerse the audience in one way or another, but they will use different techniques, and some will be super directed and some will be much more casual and laid back. And I try and reflect that certainly in the first cuts that I do. So had the film, I think the film had influenced the team because obviously it was sort of a recreation of that world in television. But Guy had done the first two episodes. So Guy had set the standard already. So it's not like he had created this world with James Herbert and his team. They'd stamped how they wanted to be already. And so our job was really to come in and start working, trying to do something similar to that. And I think we pushed it probably a little bit too far in the sort of garagey 2022 with lots of a little bit too much sort of flash frame cutting and concertina of time and things like that. And it was interesting because the guy came in and said, that's Guy Ritchie 2000 and 2001. I want Guy Ritchie 2023, please. check out this. This is a much more relaxed type of filmmaking.
Okay.
Much more grown up, I think, this style. I can't remember. It was very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, that is fascinating to hear how he was even interpreting his own style as it progressed through time. I'm curious, how did working on this differ from the other projects that you've worked on?
Well, Guy Ritchie, that's how it differed.
Yeah, same order yeah. to that.
Yeah, absolutely. So Guy has an exceptionally lively mind, and he will not rest until he's absolutely sure he's got the best story he can get. And so he will basically, I mean, I have never received notes that are more complicated than Guy's. And I have to say, I would sit in the room with him. I'd listen to the notes. I'd assiduously tell him, always write the notes down. That is another, and I don't mean that as in, oh, you should have the notes, but be seen to be writing the notes down. People love it if you're writing the notes down. And it's also really useful for you because you can interpret them, the way you understand them and then at a later date, you look back and you can actually make sense out of them. So always write down the notes. So there I was, assiduously rushed down the notes. And as he would give them, I was thinking, there is no way I could do this. It's just that I just don't think I can pull this off. The footage isn't there. The characters don't do that. Neither. And then I'd go away and I'd spend a few hours, of working in Where Is It? And I'd find that I could do it. how does he know that this is possible? And so, yeah, they are the toughest editorial nuts I've received. And there's something in his brain, I think. I think he's quite dyslexic. And I'm dyslexic too. And they're very visual thinkers. So I think there's something in his mind that he sort of collates it subconsciously, or maybe it's consciously, I'm not sure, and kind of knows how far he can push the material and what he thinks he can get out of it. So that was the big difference on the show was working with Guy. I mean, I've only worked with two, what you might refer to as big time directors, Guy and Ridley, and they're both very big characters and they know what they want and they're very clear about what they want. And it's kind of it's an exciting experience working with them. Because they have this, they're sort of true filmmakers, in that respect, I guess they were that it was it's there was a similarity on Taboo, but yeah, Guy was the big difference.
Was there a best piece of advice you got from him, working throughout this process?
Was there a best piece of advice I got from Guy? Wow, that's a good question. That's a great question. I hadn't thought of that, actually. Best advice I got from Billy. He often talked of rhythm. Of rhythm of performance, rhythm of the cut, and how they should marry. And I thought that was really quite an interesting perspective on how you structure scenes, particularly. He works a lot with... James Herbert, the editor. And James got he's very good with rhythm. And he can do things in the cut which are quite spectacularly clever. I think their latest film, Ministry of Undoubted Behavior, It's amazing. It's like a huge, it's incredible romp of a sort of, is it an action movie? It's a sort of Second World War action film. And it's just this it has such an amazing forward momentum. And it's so enjoyable for that. And it's that sense of rhythm in the cut and musicality of the cut. And I think that's probably what I took most of it. Although what was really interesting watching Guy work was the rewriting of characters in the cast as well. So he would rewrite ADR and give that a rhythm too. Yeah, he's very, very rhythmical in his thinking, I think, in that sense. So he had when you see his films, he had the characters have this amazing sort of Guy Ritchie-esque dialogue, and that has a real rhythm to it. And he would come back and he'd just do these rhythmical, poetic beats. And I think in two or three of these shows have these sort of long, maybe four or five actually, long rhythmical poetic moments where the characters are telling you something, describing something. And it was really interesting to be given I would definitely call it poetry, and be allowed to then recut the scenes around it and structure the images to follow that poetic narrative.
Yeah, that is fascinating. Guy didn't direct the episode you worked on technically, correct? So
no,
what was it?
Executive producer.
What is that dynamic like? Okay, yeah. What is that dynamic like in getting notes from him, getting notes from the director?
It can be on some shows, it can be a bit tricky. It depends on how you set it up. So on most American shows, the director isn't around after a while. They get between 4 and 6 days in the cut, and then it's all show over. But obviously Guy is not around. He's so busy. He's shooting like 3 films sometime a year. I mean, he's just a machine. So he's off on it. I think he shot he did his 2 episodes. Then he went away and shot a film. Then he came back and exec produced some episodes before he went away to shoot another film. And and I think they'd almost finished Ministry by the time we finished. They had finished Ministry by the time The Gentleman's finished. So he's just working. It's insane. So Iran stayed around as well to sort of oversee the process and help work through the notes. And so, yeah, Guy would come in. I think he'd give us, like, every sort of other day, he'd be able, and then remember, there are 6 shows happening at once. Guy would come in and give us an hour or two every other day or every third day. And then he'd give us his notes, and then he'd leave us to get on with them. So it was fairly straightforward in that respect. I mean, I say straightforward in that respect. The notes are really tricky, but the process.
Question I forgot to ask was, I'm curious how long you actually worked. How long does it take you or an editor in general to work on a episode that is on like a Netflix series?
That's another good question. So it's quite a movable feast. So The Gentleman, episode 6 had been assembled. In fact, all the episodes I worked on had been assembled prior to my arrival. And I think that is a very, some people don't like that, but I find it very useful. You do have to then go and dig into the rushes in a way which feels like taking a back a step. But what an assembled episode allows you to do is see the story and see the characters, at least a version of the story of characters that are in the film. And you can see how the style of filmmaking has been employed. And you very quickly can, I think when I look at a cut, I can see behind what's been presented. So I'll look at the cut and I think, okay, there's more to this scene, or they've had to work really hard to make this scene work because there's not enough coverage. And so having that available is very, very good. So then it took me, I think on The Gentleman, it took me 2 weeks, or might have been 3, to do a recut, and then a further couple of weeks to do another recut on top of that. And then there were notes And then it becomes a little bit hazy because I was working on another episode at the same time, so I couldn't be precise on how many days that was, because I would do some notes on this episode, then jump back into the other one, and then I'd get some more notes, and I'd do those, and then jump back into the other one, forward into another one. So it becomes, but that's, you know, it can take much longer as well. Yeah, I think it takes me about a week to recut an episode after I've assembled it. And then with director's notes, probably another week I can get something into shape. So probably it's 2 weeks after I've assembled it to get something worth watching. Anyway, you're lucky sometimes and you've got something worth watching immediately after you've assembled it.
Sure.
And then it's just a movable feast. It depends. It depends on how the production wants to take the show forwards. And then that can be, you know, it could be really, really quick, few weeks, or it can take months.
That is fascinating. I find it really interesting that you're given an assembly cut that an assistant editor has put together. And I think a lot of editors could just take that and just try and make something good out of what they were given. But to hear you actually diving back into the rushes, the dailies, the raw material to go, hey, I'm going to actually be proactive in this and make sure that I have done my due diligence in that I'm working with the best of the best and trying to solve every problem and tell the most compelling story.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I like to do the best job I can. You know, I really want to make the best out of the material, the best out of performances. And until you've actually gone back into the rushes, in fact, no, that's not true. I can usually see that the film that could be there as I watch the rushes, depending on how obscured it's been by that first cut. And some of them can be amazing, and some of them can be very obscure. But you can usually see behind what's been presented. You can see a really great piece of performance, and you can think to yourself, okay, I know there's more to that take. I know he'll do those other bits of the scene in that take, or she'll do that. She's done an amazing bit of performance here. I'm sure there's more in that. And also, grammar is real key to storytelling. So as well as you're doing cinematic storytelling, for me, is almost all about grammar. Once you've got performances right, once you've got, and I'm not talking about me, once the actors are doing amazing performances, you've got a fantastic cast, and the director's done an amazing job, and you've got great shots, then it's about cinematic grammar, and that is about telling the story in the correct, it's almost as simple as correct shot size at the correct moment. You know, shot size underlines the importance of a dramatic statement. So if you're in a close-up, whatever that person's saying or doing is super important. If you're in a medium wide shot, whatever they're saying is not so important. So the structure of a scene changes. You know, you arrive at the scene, you let them say not so important stuff in a medium wide shots. I know this sounds really simple, but this is it. And then as it gets more important, as it gets more intense, you move into those close-ups. And then you move out again. And again, that storytelling, that structure, you need to understand what the most important thing is said in that scene in order to choose where you need to be in terms of cinematic grammar. And yeah, it gets more complicated because then you have the tonality of a shot, and you can, and directors and teams will use, you know, low angle shots, or they'll do really interesting lighting, and all those aspects affect how your audience perceives a narrative beat. You know, the lighting across someone's face, are they cast into shadow? That makes them look quite evil. Okay, so this, if they're going to say something quite evil in this scene, then that's the shot you should be using. Maybe just save that shot for the one moment where that character turns and he becomes, or he, she becomes, you know, she puts something into her performance, into her delivery, or there's this moment in the script which turns that character's corner into the darker realm, and you just use that moment once, and then you're back into the other shots. Because you stepped away from it again. So cinematic grammar is also really, really important. I've forgotten where I started this. I sort of trailed off into...
No, I love that idea of cinematic grammar, of hearing, seeing like what it would take to put together a compelling scene. And that phrase, cinematic grammar, I don't think I've heard that before. And I just love that there is a way of speaking this visual language, and there are those rules. I think a lot of times when you talk about, oh, when I look through the rushes, I'm able to just kind of see the story that's there. I wonder, well, how do you see that? Is that just something that comes with time? Is there a way to cut that time down then for editors? And that idea of cinematic grammar of, now this is something you can learn. You can learn how to speak just like any other language. And that comes through the reading and watching, like you've said, which is really, really fascinating. I am curious if there was like a favorite scene in the episodes that you cut. If like there's a moment that stands out of the gentleman that you're like, this is like my favorite thing that I put together. And you can brag on yourself a bit.
I usually that's very kind of you, let me brag. And my tastes are quite kind of simple, I guess. Yeah, the one moment that stands out for me that I remember, and I'm sure everyone else is just like, yeah, whatever, was the, we call it the breakup scene between Susie Glass and Eddie. And it was just a really simple shot, reverse shot scene. But I just love the emotional tone around it. And it was just a moment of which basically they realized that they were in opposition. And it's like a key turning point in the series. And it was so simply shot, just little tracking in shots towards the two characters. And I just really enjoyed that moment. Then there's the boxing scene, of course. Really like the boxing scene. And I'd watched some of the work that it's in episode 6 again, that James Herbert had done, and he uses this really interesting image stabilization. So it'll stabilize part of the scene, and then the rest of the image will, so it zooms in a little bit, and the whole rest of the scene moves around it. And I started to employ this in the boxing sequence, and I'd never used it before, and I was quite stunned at what it did. It gives the image a really graphic feel. So every now and again, you'll get these really sort of graphical movements within the fight sequence in the boxing scene. I was quite pleased with that as a technique. And then I suppose there are a few that I quite liked. And then again, another really simple scene was the, I think it's one of the opening scenes. I think it's the opening scene in episode 6. When Eddie is talking to Vinnie Jones, when Theo is talking to Vinnie Jones, and they're talking about, he talks about patience and how you should leave your slow gin. You can't just whack it at a thing and then drink it. You've got to leave it for quite some time. And it's all about patience. And there's a metaphor for being careful and not rushing into things with these gangsters. I really like that scene as well. So yeah, so I guess those are the scenes that I really like most. Some really composed scenes where characters are doing something really interesting to each other, or they're discovering something, or there's a key turning point. And then, yeah, the boxing is just, I mean, it's sort of fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, lots of editing fun.
Absolutely. That energy that those scenes have. It's cool. I think a lot of time people forget that editors, how much we love story. And, you know, can kind of think of editors as just like, oh, they're just like a machine that's just putting together the thing. But the story is actually really written and created in the front end. And then just they were like, here, monkey, do your thing. And really, it's like, no, we're writers, we're directors, we're minded all very similarly. We're just specializing in a different thing. And the story is so, yeah. It's just crafted a third time. Okay, some rapid fire questions for you. What are you primarily cutting on?
Avid.
Is that what the gentleman was cut on? Is that what you used?
Yes. I mean, I've always cut on Avid. But we usually use Avid because you can project share really easily. So you can have an open project. Your assistants can be changing things in the project while you're working because the bins are openable on the system. I don't think anything else has managed to do that yet. I might be behind the times. I used to cut on Final Cut, and so they bought Final Cut 10 out and threw away all the hotkeys, which was quite upsetting at the time. But then I moved back onto Avid.
Very cool. If there was like one piece or style or genre of content that you would want to cut, what would it be?
I've been really lucky. I've cut across pretty much all the genres and styles of content so far. I love storytelling, I love characters. And so in a way, it's about story, it's about the characters, about the script, about the actors, And that's what draws me to a project more than the genre. I'm probably quite good at dark stuff. I think that's kind of my, although I do comedy, you know, The Gentleman's comedy and the film I cut before that was comedy. I've just recently cut a James McAvoy film called Tunnel of the Sun. And that's really quite dark. And it was a real contrast from The Gentleman.
How so?
It's where The Gentleman is like having fun with the characters in a heightened world. You've got these wonderful characters. And I thought the use of tone was really lovely. Chris Benson, the composer, he's a fantastic composer. And that classical score mixed with the stately mansions and then the underworld was really great. So it's a heightened world. Whereas Tunnel of the Sun is about jealousy and it's about regret and it's really confined. It's a group of five characters are sort of confined together in a house, and it's about how one of them torments one washed up artist torments a younger up and coming artist, and it's lots of psychology and and it's like a little boiling pot, and it's much more confined than the Guy Ritchie show. So it's a real contrast in that respect, and very enjoyable. James McAvoy is amazing.
When does that come out?
In fact, I don't know, we're posting it at the moment, so okay. it's not like a big TV affair. It's going to be one of these festival pieces.
Cool. Yeah. What advice would you give to editors that are looking to work on this type of bigger budget TV and feature film content?
In what sense? Do you mean how to get the work, or what would you do when you get it?
Let's go both.
Okay. All the advice. I would say, so really, how to get the work is a really tough question. There's so much luck involved in it. You find a good director and hopefully they love what you do, and you work with them and you keep working them and you get a CV together. That's one way of doing it. Or you work with a director who's not in that space, and hopefully they're trying to crack that space, like I did with John Wright. He wasn't a features director, but he tried for 9 years to crack the space. He got his first feature film, Eternity Within. It's about being lucky about, and I'd try and be strategic about it if you can. It's very difficult. It's about luck and where you are at the right time, if you're available. If you're not doing something else, you have to pay the rent as well. I mean, I paid the rent. Newcastle documentaries for years, but it meant I couldn't do other things. Very difficult. I don't regret doing documentaries at all. It taught me a lot. I'll just jump into documentary really quickly. I think what you have to do in documentaries is you scour the material and you really scrutinize it and think about every frame and try and build something out of that. I think that's transferred into my drama and feature work. Like really scrutinize the material, really try and make the best of it. What were we saying? How to get the work? Oh, yeah. So, yeah, it's about the directors you connect with. It's about them being happy with your work. And don't be too, certainly in your early career, don't be too worried about, try and be adventurous, try and be creative. Have one eye on making things work, but another one, be relaxed and free with the material as well. I think it's really important. I think some younger editors can get a bit too tight with the material. It's a big job, editing. You've got an enormous amount of choices. Every time a frame goes away, it passes, you've made a choice not to cut. And if you think about the amount of material that is in the cutting room, there could be 30, 40, 50 hours of material, and every frame, every 24th of a second, you're choosing not to cut to any one of those other frames in that 50 hours of material. And again, I'll just jump into that. The James McAvoy show, it was very free. So we intercut different scenes from all over the place. It's a really elliptical cut, and it really made me think, you know, often with TV, you've got a linear narrative that's very clear and structured and scripted. With this show, because it was improvised, that narrative is very, very malleable. But again, so as an editor, you can be, you're faced with millions of choices all the time. And I think it can be overwhelming in that respect. So when you're doing the work, you should focus on what you're trying to achieve at any one moment. And that is about storytelling. It's about character. So to part two of the question, what advice would I give to people? I would say read books on scripts, on script writing, on character arcs, on character structure. There are some fantastic books out there. I read this. One fantastic book was Creating Character Arcs by K.M. Wayland. And that really dissects how a character is, you know, if the story is correct, the plot and the character and the themes are absolutely all the same thing. So the plot uncovers the character by forcing them to make choices and reveals the themes as well by the choices that are part of the character. So that was really interesting. Into the Woods was another one that I've written. Read. So Into the Woods by John York is a great book that I've read. And Story Fairy is another great book. Surname but three. Save the Cat, Grace as well. But they all give you little bits of the puzzle. Because editing is just one constant puzzle. And that's what's great about the notes as well. It's just reformatting the puzzle. So as part two of your question is I would dive into story and character and really learn that as much as you can. And another reason for doing that is executive producers and directors spend, I'd say, 2/3 of their lives writing and discussing scripts. And these books all talk about stories in the form of scripts almost entirely. And of course, when you hit the cutting room, you can use the same terminology, the same language to describe and explain what you're doing and to discuss what is required of the next iteration in the cut. And so it's that ability to communicate is really, really important in the cutting room. You know, if you sit there and people give you notes, and you can help them as well. Someone will give you notes, I don't like it when this character does that. And you can say, all right, okay, well, let's discuss what it is that the character's doing. So at this point in his arc or her arc, it's the moment before the midpoint. At this point, this character should be discovering what they're missing in order to complete their arc. But upon discovering that, they're still not going to be able to, you know, actually... complete themselves because they still have the rest of Act 2 to go through. Otherwise, it'd be boring. The film would be over. So what it is, you know, if we don't have this beat, what can we do instead? Or is this beat delivering too much? Or does the character know too much? You know, what is it about this moment that's bumping you? And so at that point, they can then feel comfortable and confident that you're speaking in terms that they understand and that you understand what they're saying. Yeah, for me, the content is what drives me. Like I said earlier, it is those characters and those moments I've talked about those turning points. You know, they're key moments, and they are what really creates the characters in the audience's mind. So they're really important to get those moments right, and to do that, you need to understand story and character arts, so structure and characters. And I think grammar is really important for this moment. Choosing that key moment to be in that close-up, that's the moment one character's really put pressure on another, or one character's really a recognition is sparked in their mind that the person opposite them is not who they thought to it.
Yeah, agreed. Thank you so much, Matt, for the time and for being willing to just share your insights into the editorial process, sharing your journey and what it's like to work on this type of content. I think it's been, or I know it's been an absolute joy just to talk to you and hear the depth of which you understand story and your craft and how the just professionalism that you bring to this. And I'm curious how we and other listeners can keep up with your work and future endeavors.
IMDb is really good for that. I'm on there. Check it out. I'm terrible. I don't have a website or anything. I probably should. But yeah, IMDb. You'll see what I'm doing, what's coming up next. Sort of. And I just want to say thank you so much for having me on this show. It's been lovely to meet you and talk to you.
Likewise.
Absolutely. Yep. Thank you.